Thank you, Carissa, for sharing that beautiful song with us and for sharing your summer with us, by the way. She's not quite concluded her work here, but only has another week or two, and we can't believe the summer is speeding by us like it is. I was just reflecting as Carissa was singing about how our summer music, while the choir is sort of in their summer rhythm, the specials have sort of been in the family with Nora and with William and with Carissa. We have been treated to something very special this summer, and it's been enjoyable to have all of those come our way. Another thing that is a little more subtle that has come your way is that you have begun to sample some of the music from the new hymnal that we'll begin using in just a very few weeks. I hope you notice that there is a turn of the page to your worship bulletin after the benediction. Don't miss that. There's a little bit left to go, including us doubling back to that Give Thanks song that we shared just a few minutes ago. So be ready for that as we close our worship service today. I'm also reminded, because I have been with congregations as new hymnals came before, including this new hymnal in our Atlanta congregation, and I know what people say. I don't like all these new songs, I just want to sing the old songs. I know you say that, because I've heard people say that, and we fully expect you to say that. I also bet you, some point soon, right after you say that and walk away, I bet it dawns on you eventually, all the old songs were new songs at one time, and somebody griped about them. So be ready with good spirits as we get the new hymnals into use, but we're sharing in that already, and I'm appreciative of Steve going ahead and mixing some of those songs in. You heard the parable just a little bit ago from the 13th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, and it picks up on the theme of a sower. And should leave us perplexed, as most parables do, a little bit. I was every bit of 7 or 8 years old when my mother decided that it was time for us, my brother and I, to learn the secrets of growing a vegetable garden. As you've heard me allude, I grew up on a small farm in the outskirts of what's now Metro Atlanta. It's not a farmland anymore, but back then we all had farms. And we had acreage, and every year my parents planted a garden. That particular year, though, my brother and I were going to be invited in to have a stake in the game. Actually, Elizabeth's favorite term for these kind of things probably applies better here. Invited is not the right word. Her word is voluntold. My mother voluntold us that we were going to begin planting things in the garden that year. She felt like we were both old enough. And so she got us out there. My dad had used the tiller to get the rows ready. We had the seed. My mother showed us exactly how she wanted them planted, how far apart the holes were to be dug, how deep the holes were to be dug, and how they were to be covered up and watered in the process. The seeds had no doubt been bought at Chadwick's store up on Highway 140, just up from our house, or they had been purchased at Hawkins Feed and Seed in my little town of Roswell, where, incidentally, legend has it that I once climbed up onto a snapper riding lawnmower that was in a display window, and somebody left the keys in it. And I turned the key, and that lawnmower jumped, and we almost rode that lawnmower right through a plate glass window about 5 feet off the ground. Yeah, that place, or Chadwick's, one of those is where the seed had come from, and it wasn't just any old bean seed. I'm sure my mother was intentional about what was planted in the garden, and as frugal as she was, I know she had not exceeded the estimated number of seeds that would be needed, and so we had to do the job right, or we would run out of seeds, and we would be in trouble. Now, here is where, in full disclosure, I ought to admit to you that the gardening bug never bit me. I never fell in love with the romantic notion of gardening, at least not on the scale we had to do it. Everything was big in my home place because of it being a farm, not a hobby garden out in the backyard, and especially to two little boys who were rather disinterested. I would far rather have been playing ball than working in the garden, and so there we went, and I never fell in love with it. I do have to admit, though, that as those plants began to emerge from the ground, it was exciting. We would go out just about every day and monitor the change in those bean plants and breathe a sigh of relief as most of them began to burst up from the ground. It was more fun than I cared to admit to my parents at that time. Until a few weeks later, when my mother again volunteered us that it was now time to pick the beans, and we would be the labor that got those beans harvested. My brother and I went back out and worked again. We thought we would never get all the beans planted, and we thought we would never get all of the beans picked. I can't assume that my mom's way of planting would be the only way to successfully raise up a bean crop. So you can imagine that I am no authority on the agricultural ways of the people of Jesus' time and place 2,000 years ago. But any of us can read this parable that Tom just shared with us a few minutes ago and notice that it somehow seems wasteful. A sower went out to sow. Theodore Wardlaw asks the question in his writing on this parable, what do we make of a sower who throws seeds everywhere, even in such unlikely, seemingly unproductive places? What sort of worldview is suggested by someone who throws seeds on a well-worn path where the only thing that can happen is for birds to come along and eat them later? Or on rocky ground where it's unlikely they will grow, or among thorns that will choke them? These days, after listening eagerly to Walter Reeves' gardening show on WSB AM in Atlanta, my mom talks a lot of soil amendments. That's her fancy terminology that she's learned for getting everything just right and being sure that the nutrients that'll be needed for what you plant will be there waiting when the seeds grow into the ground. Well, good farmers or rank amateurs, we all know that the logical place to start if you're going to plant something is in good soil. Church starts. Missionaries headed to work in the field, and businesses of every kind have to consider the same question. Why would you plant good seeds in bad soil? Seems wasteful if you're likely to fail predictably in those places. Jesus was developing a strong track record, a reputation with his ministry. And with that renown, though, was already coming a parallel reality. In some places, he was, as you know, rejected along with his message. Not everyone was excited, it turns out, about his prophecies and his values. Not everyone was excited about his healings and his teachings and his telling of a kingdom to come. Jesus was preparing the disciples to go out on their own and to preach and heal in God's name. So he dug in deeply to be sure he was teaching them well and preparing them for the resistance that they too would inevitably meet. It sounds in some ways a little like the day and age and culture in which we live. This parable, if you flip back through your Bible, this parable was placed in between stories of opposition to the gospel. Chapters 11 and 12 contain multiple stories of opposition, and chapter 13 later will end with the story of Jesus being rejected in his own hometown. We have visited that story, at least by mention, in the last few weeks. Why did the good news of what God was doing find a willing reception, it seemed, in some places, only to find a tepid response or outright rejection in other places? Well, in a rare move, Matthew names this parable for us, the parable of the sower, right there in verse 18. But one scholar has suggested that this parable could just as easily have been called the parable of the four soils or the parable of the miraculous yields. And today, I question whether it might not be the parable of the wasteful sower. Jesus went out by the water, and sat down. And a crowd gathered around him so great that he got out in a boat and pushed out into the water and turned around and began to teach them as they had crowded onto the beach where he had just stepped out. A sower went out to sow. And he sowed. Some seeds fell on the path and the birds came and ate them up. You heard this just a few minutes ago. Other seeds fell on rocky ground where they didn't have much soil and they sprang up quickly since they had no depth of soil. But when the sun rose, they were scorched. And since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. And other seeds fell on good soil and brought forth grain, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. Let anyone with ears listen. Really? Some have suggested that in Jesus' time, they cast the seed by hand and then plowed the ground. It was, in essence, a scattershot approach, if true. Seed just flying anywhere nearby, onto rocky soil, onto hard soil, into the weeds and thorns, but inevitably some of it into good soil too. If you followed along in your Bible, then you know the reaction this parable brought from his disciples. In the verses we left out for today in our reading, their reaction was not to begin to unpack the natural questions that the parable raised. They didn't go right into discussing the allegory that might be involved here. No, they immediately asked him, "Lord, why do you teach the people using parables?" A parable has been suggested to be a story that's used for teaching. But not just a story that causes a comparison, although comparison is inherent with the parables. We talked about this a week ago. A parable is really a riddle that one person has suggested teases the mind into inquiring to know more and guides the mind to seek after a truth. Scholar Talitha Arnold has pointed out about this parable that Jesus didn't just teach with this story. He was living this parable out right in front of them already when he told it. And in giving this story, Jesus was in part readying his disciples for what was ahead based on what they were seeing now. She says that first century Palestine, and see if this sounds familiar, first century Palestine was a hard place and time to be living as a Christian. Due to poverty and persecution, we could substitute recession and economic change. People were moving out of the region. That part does not seem to be true about Franklin, actually. There were false prophets, and sometimes they got people's attention and caused distraction. People questioned the validity of Christianity and why anyone would choose to believe this upstart faith. That ought to sound familiar about our day. The soil, so to speak, was mixed and tough in Christianity in Jesus' day. But still, we are left with the question, why would a sower waste perfectly good seeds in bad ground? After all, we've heard Jesus talk about in other places the waste of time that, for instance, casting pearls before swine would be. And that is the perplexing detail that absolutely will not leave us alone in this parable. We took back up in our reading a few minutes ago with verse 18, though, and Jesus does something that does not happen in nearly all the parables. He begins to offer an interpretation for us. "Hear then," he says, "the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what is sown in the heart. This is what was sown on the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet such a person has no root, but endures only for a while. And when trouble or persecution arises on account of the word, that person immediately falls away. As for what was sown among the thorns," Jesus says, "this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of the world and the lure of wealth choke out the word, and it yields nothing. But as for what was sown on good soil, well, this is the one who hears the word and understands it, and who indeed bears fruit and yields in one case 100-fold, in another 60, and in another 30. Ah, finally, at least we hear Jesus tell us what he thinks the lesson ought to be. Mark that down. And still, though, it doesn't satisfy our chief curiosity. It doesn't answer our question. Not every person who receives the gospel will hang on to it and internalize it. We listen to Jesus' explanation, and secretly images begin to pass in front of us. We know people who have been each one of these kinds of soil. In chapters of our lives, perhaps we ourselves have been one or more of these kinds of soil that Jesus illustrates, no doubt. My friend Steve Beecham is a home mortgage broker, and he's made a fine living financing people's home purchases. And lately he's been writing books and traveling different parts of the country to speak to businesses and to groups. He's also, though, one of the more colorful characters that I knew growing up in my hometown. When I was a kid, about 4 years younger than Steve, he was a scary guy to me. If I went somewhere with his cousins and we went and hung out with Steve and his friends, I was terrified because Steve had no filter. There was nothing across his line because he didn't have a line. And so he finished college and he came back to our hometown. He went into business and eventually he began to try to get into the business of home mortgages. And he found the going to be tough at first. And he didn't account for this because his mother was replete with friends who were real estate agents, and he knew that those old friends would send him business. And he thought it would be easy to get into that line of work in our town. And so when things didn't start off very well for him, he pulled one of his mother's longtime friends aside and he said, "Please, tell me honestly, what am I missing? Why are none of you all sending clients with real estate to me for a loan?" And his mother's friend said, "Steve, honey, we've known you since you were a child. We love you. But all we can remember of you is that you were impulsive. You sometimes had poor judgment. And those aren't really good characteristics of a mortgage officer. And it's why people might be a little hesitant to send business of this importance to you." Well, Steve tells groups now that regardless of your trade, churches included, you have to know what he calls your buzz in the community. You have to know your buzz locally. You have to know what people are saying about you and what the word is out there on you or your group or your business. Well, Jesus was well acquainted with what the buzz was on him out and about. He knew people's reactions to what he was doing, and he knew that his disciples were going to have to be ready for what would inevitably come their way too. Douglas Hare says that a first century Galilean farmer, as far as the image Jesus used to try to teach this, he said a first century Galilean farmer would have considered a 10 bushel return on a bushel of seed planted to be a very good return. In fact, a 7.5-fold return might have been much more normal. So when Jesus tells this parable and speaks of returns that are 100-fold, 60-fold, or even 30, a Galilean farmer of Jesus' time wouldn't have allowed themselves to dream of such good fortune. And Jesus was obviously speaking to the supernatural presence of God that would be present for them as they drew upon it to aid and strengthen and bless their ministries. A parable about a sower who went out to sow. A parable that inevitably causes our minds to come back to and consider the nature of the God who has created us, who has offered redemption to us, the God who walks with us in our lives and wants the very best for us across our lifetime. Our God loves us so much and is so lavish with love that it looks like waste if you're only counting seeds, as in Jesus' parable. But when we switch over to a different kind of ledger, when we evaluate the story Jesus told by a different criteria, God becomes the kindest and wisest farmer imaginable. God plants seeds in all of us. God distributes seeds into all kinds of soil, giving every one of us the same chance and the same nature of love. And that is the best news that a parable of Jesus could deliver. We cannot outgive a God who plants with a heart like this. A God who doesn't just put the seeds in the soil, but who nurtures the results and accompanies each of us to the fullest extent we'll allow. A God who gives everyone a fair chance and a second chance and a third chance and beyond. That kind of God, that kind of wise presence is in whose hands you and I can be this day and every day as we live our lives. A wasteful sower? I think not. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, hometown cooking and home cooking was still the mainstream, but restaurants had become popular, especially in the 40s and 50s. And by the late 50s and into the 60s, a new concept was beginning to pop up. It was called franchising and multiple locations. One company emerged from that new movement and got out ahead of everyone else. They're on nearly every street corner sometimes, it seems. Their name is recognizable, and their golden arches are just as recognizable. Was there something McDonald's did better than everyone else when considering where to put their restaurants? So the story goes, there actually is something they got better at than everybody else. Almost anyone thinking about opening a franchise, a place for fast food, a place to eat, would go into a neighborhood and talk with people. We'd call it market research, market survey. But they'd ask people questions that mostly gave them the news they hoped to hear. McDonald's realized early on that there was one more question they needed to be asking. If you went into an area back then and asked people if they would like to have more alternatives, more options for where they might eat, most of them would have said yes. If you went into an area and asked people if they would like to be able to buy burgers and fries conveniently, a lot of people would say yes. McDonald's added one more question to all those kinds of things that everybody was asking. McDonald's thought to ask people, if we put our store on this corner, will you come in and buy burgers and fries from us? And that gave them more accurate information than a lot of the other companies were getting early in the game, so it seems. McDonald's made sure that they were planting in good soil as they went out and into business. The parable of the sower sheds light on a God who wants the very, very best for us. But a God who is willing to consider all of us good soil and does not seem to discriminate as we do when we plant seeds. That is a God that we cannot live without. That is a God we cannot outlove. That is a God we cannot outpace in lavish generosity. And that is the God to whom we give thanks today. Thanks be to God. We sing a hymn of response just now. The hymn is number 644, Count Your Blessings.